You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. For those of you in Dallas, know that we've had some inclement weather that closed a lot of schools, including Richland College. And I was starting my show Wednesday when abruptly about 4:30, 4:35, right about then, I was about 25 minutes into what I thought was going to be a two-hour show. I had a lot of material prepared in terms of the news stories when we were informed that the campus was closing at 4:30, which meant I had to get out of the studio because they were going to shut the offices down, and I packed up my things and left, and I was probably home by 5 o'clock, and I anticipated being on the air to about 6 because I had a lot of material and was going to do a two-hour show, but I announced everyone that at least was listening should get off campus. Well, what happened was an ice storm came, hits Dallas, and I'm originally from New York, New Jersey area. We're used to snowstorms, especially I lived on Long Island, where we'd have these snowstorms that would pile 3-4 feet of snow. And at least when I was a kid, would have to go out and clean the driveway as well as the walks. And we're used to that kind of weather, that kind of driving conditions. I used to also live in Ohio, where we'd get hit with snowstorms and would drive on snow and ice. So I'm used to that, but Texans aren't. And when you get a little bit of ice, there's panic. And I stay off the roads because they don't know how to drive in it, because it only happens maybe once or twice a year. And this is a little bit early. It usually happens the early part of January and maybe one more time in March. Those are the most frequent, though, were in early January, the early part of January. Well, this was new, and this was a fairly severe one because the school was closed Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, which surprised me, and I'll tell you why. I called twice, Friday and Saturday, to see whether or not the school was going to be open. I did not expect it to be open either Friday and Saturday because the roads were very, very bad. They were iced, and especially the bridges. Now, I could drive to and from my apartment to Richland College and only really had to cross one bridge over a major highway that would have been sanded because it's a well-traveled. But I stayed home. And what happened to me Friday was I listened to a lot of talk radio, and one of the shows I listened to was the Charlie Jones Show that's on from 12 to 4. Well, I couldn't sleep, so I was listening to the show, but I noticed my electricity was going on and off. Now, not the lights were going on and off, but I have an alarm clock. If there's any interruption in power, it starts blinking, and I have to reset the time. So I reset it probably 4 or 5 times. Then I really fell asleep. And when I got up, probably 5 or 6 hours later, no lights, no alarm clock, no nothing. And it was getting colder and colder and colder. So I figured my electricity was out for at least 10 to 12 hours. And I called the power company and just left a message. I assumed other people had called, and about 12 hours later, and that's just my ballpark figure, I had electricity. But it was getting dark and cold, and I was getting a little bit concerned because even though I dressed up or was under the covers, I wasn't freezing. I would, in essence, be in the dark because there was very, very, in my apartment, there's some light, but if the sun's not out, I'm not going to get any light from the windows, or very, very little. So it's more or less pitch black in my kitchen and my bathroom and a good part of the bedroom. And I wasn't alone. There were hundreds of thousands of people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that lost their electricity. And it took them a good 2 days. It took them Saturday and Sunday. And I got a call Sunday, is your electricity, one of these automatic dials, is your electricity still out? And I pressed the right buttons and told them, yeah, I got electricity. But I wasn't alone. There were several hundred thousand, I think upwards of 400,000 people that lost electricity throughout the Dallas area. And that's not typical. That's rather unusual. You know, occasionally the lights will go out, but it's usually an hour, either a few minutes, maybe an hour or two, but 12 hours is a long time, because I'm in the heart of Dallas, in North Dallas, not far from the campus, on a major, I'm not going to give my address, but I'm on a major street. Matter of fact, we have electrical towers not too far from where I live. So something happened, and usually it was ice, because I noticed during the following days when I finally got out Sunday and drove to the campus, because I was told over the phone they have a message that you can call if there's inclement weather, and I called it, and they said the campus was open. I was a little bit surprised, but the roads looked fairly clear. So Sunday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, I drove over to the campus, mainly because I had a final assignment to do. I'm taking a course in English that I really don't need, but I knew they had an assignment that was due Sunday, or by the end of Sunday. So I drove over here expecting the campus to be open to go to the computer labs and Del Rio lab. That's the building the computer lab is in. And lo and behold, the parking lot is empty. And I followed in the campus police patrol car. So I got out of the car, went to the building, found it locked tight. I thought it was going to be locked tight because I didn't see any cars in the parking lot. And now there are a number of parking places, but I thought I'd at least try the door to see if it was open. It was locked tight. And I went back to my car, and the patrol unit, I guess, was a little suspicious. But I knew one of the officers in the car, and I said, "Hey, I called ahead, and they said the campus is open. You guys, your left hand needs to know what the right hand is doing. You need to change that message, because I'm only about 2 minutes away. I'm about 2 miles away, but about 5 minutes away." And it was clean, more or less a clean shot. There was a little slush on the road. I didn't have any trouble, but some people have to drive many, many miles here. So it's rather critical that the telephone message that people are relying on there's a number you call to find out whether or not the campus is open. Well, it was indicating that it was open, and I was surprised. Well, Monday, it really warmed up a little bit. The streets were obviously cleared. So I drove over in the morning, fully expecting the college to be open. I didn't even call ahead because I said I can't rely on that. I'll just shoot over there. If it's closed, I'll do some shopping. Because you get cabin fever when you're holed up in your home. And many people were holed up for 4, some even 5 days. So I drove over to the campus, and lo and behold, it shut down. And you could tell because we have our administration building where people go to register and take care of things, financial aid, whatever. It's called Thunder Duck Hall, and all the flags were down. So I figured, nope, it shut down. And I didn't see any campus police, but there were one or two cars that apparently had the same idea I had, that the campus should be open. And it was absolutely no problem driving that day. It was actually much better than Sunday. Sunday was a little slush on the road. Monday, clean shot, and I was really surprised, and I was a little somewhat concerned, not a big concern. I said, I need to get this English assignment in. It's an online course I'm taking, and you need to have a computer access. Now, I don't own a computer. I rely on the computer labs to get internet access as well as prepare for the show. So it's rather critical that I have access. And I even tried the Dallas Public Library, the Forest Lane branch. Well, I knew it was closed Sunday. I didn't need to drive over there Sunday. But Monday I said, well, I'm only, half a mile away. I'll just go over to the Forest Lane branch. And I wasn't sure whether they were open, because their hours are rather flexible. There's been a big cutback in Dallas services, including library services, in terms of the hours. So they're usually closed 2 days a week, at least. So Sunday and Monday, guess what? They were closed, so I didn't have any internet access to the, couldn't get on either there, obviously couldn't get on the campus. Well, the next day, it was this time I called. I said, I'm not going to drive over there unless I at least get the message. So the message still could be wrong, and I called. Campus is open, but I was still a little bit concerned because on Tuesday, a lot of schools were still closed because of the icing conditions. And the problem is some of the major highways north of Dallas really got hit hard. I'm sort of in the northern part of Dallas County, the eastern northern part of Dallas County, where Richland College is. I'm in the same zip code. And it was fine, but if you went, a good 5 to 10 miles north, the roads got significant. They were significantly iced, and many people were trapped on the highways or on the side roads, the service roads, for hours, in some cases days, because the roads were so iced up you couldn't move. So we've had a lot of inclement weather problems that have impacted my show, and I want to make you aware of it. But Richland College is now back to business. This is final week. I was only taking one course, and I completed it yesterday. That's why I wasn't on the air yesterday. I was trying to get that squared away before I prepared for the show, because I'm going to have at least an hour show, and probably will go for a little bit longer if I have the material. This is kind of playing it by ear, but I wanted to give you a little update to where I'm at. I'll probably continue doing the hour shows this week. I'm not sure what the schedule will be following week. I know we're closed right before Christmas, right after Christmas, so at some point the whole studio will be shut down. But as long as the studio is open on weekdays, I plan to give an hour show each day, because I'm trying to, well, definitely get above 180 shows, but if I can do it, try to get 190 by the end of the year, and that might be pushing it, and getting, before the school starts, over 200. Now, at some point, I'm going to go to 2 hours. I've been debating that for a long time. What am I going to, I really want to go to a two-hour show every day of the week, every weekday. Because a two-hour show where I'm doing all the talking is the equivalent of a three-hour talk show. It's slightly less, but not much. Because we don't do talk. We're not equipped to do call-ins at all. We don't have any advertising. We don't have any public service announcements. So I carry the show. This is a talk show format. It's really driven by current events, news stories that I'm interested in. And this particular show will be a catch-up show, because there are a number of stories that I've researched that are a little bit old. And the first one I'm going to cover today, and this is the show or the segment is on the death of Nelson Mandela. And the last show, at the very top, I had just learned that Nelson Mandela had died. And I thought what was going to happen actually did happen. The left wing in this country, which is the Democratic Party, as well as some Republican presidents and some pundits, it was like he was made a saint. And my problem is I know a little bit about his history, and he wasn't a saint to me. Now, in South Africa, you're going to get a lot of divided opinion, but he was instrumental in making it a transition from a apartheid, white-dominated, where they had apartheid was, as far as it's white racism, where blacks and people of color were second-class citizens. And I make clear, I'm not for that. Never was, never will be. I'm more or less for freedom and liberty. At the same token, I'm not for violence to overthrow the government. And Nelson Mandela and his African FNC, the African National Congress, was a socialist, communist, terrorist party and organization. And he led the group that was responsible for terrorism in South Africa. That's why he was arrested and in jail for 27 years and finally was released. Now, he could have gotten out much sooner, but would not agree to the terms. And that party was outlawed until they made the transition, the so-called miracle transition. And he was subsequently elected leader of the South African country of South Africa. But you have to know his history and his background. And I always say you can judge a person by the company he keeps. Who were his heroes? Who do you admire? Who was he friends with? Fidel Castro? Muammar Gaddafi? Arafat? I can't think of one that I want to be friends with. They were either communist dictators. All three were, in some respects, terrorists. They were certainly not democratic leaders. All three countries were tyrannies, but those are who he admired. And he made no bones about the fact that he was a communist. As far as I'm concerned, communists are beyond the pale. They're enemies of the United States. They're not friends. They're enemies. Now, yes, the Soviet Union has fallen, but many communists are now in the leadership position, including Putin in Russia. So I'm not going to promote Nelson Mandela as the new saint. Not at all. You have to learn from history. And actually, you're going to get a split opinions on this. For the time he was leading the country, and you need to give him credit, he could have turned South Africa into another Rhodesia under Mugabe, but he didn't. To his credit. But the problem is, the problem of South Africa is the blacks primarily are still poor. The economy is growing at 3%, which is actually better than the United States. But you have massive unemployment rates, over 25%. And it's much higher amongst the youth, and that's black youth in South Africa. So why it's, you see, in the 60s, when Mandela was active, the economy of South Africa, early 60s, were growing at 6%, 7%, and even hit 8% for a while. But by the time they freed Nelson Mandela in the late 80s, the economy was a basket case. It was growing at right around 1%, or a little less. It's gotten a little bit better, but not much. And it's really run by one party, the African National Congress, the ANC. And that party has somewhat changed in the sense it gets it's a single-party country, folks. There are some other parties, but the ANC, the African National Congress, gets over 2/3 to 70% of the vote. So to the extent you have any democracy in South Africa, it's within the party. There are divisions in that party. There are some hardcore communists in the party, Marxists, and there are also people that are for free markets. And there are debates and wings of the party. Now, the trade union, or what in South Africa and England is, or Great Britain is called trade unions, over here we just call them unions. They're a big part of the ANC. But you do have divisions. But I don't see, and I've been doing research on this from people that know a lot more about South Africa than I really want to know, do not see another party really coming to the fore. There are some, but, and it has to be a party. The whites in Africa today are approximately 4% of the population. Their population is, a little over 50 million, I believe is the number. So 4 million. That's less than 10%. So the whites are a distinct minority. But guess where most of the wealth is? It's still in white hands. Close to 80%, somewhere between 75-80% of the wealth in the country is still controlled by whites. And there's definitely the way to look at it, I don't like to use class categories, but you need to understand this. This is a so-called developing country, but it has a high income inequality, what's called a I want to say Q rating. And what's happened is, yes, some blacks or people of color have done well. So it's not entirely white versus black anymore. And you have a developing middle class. But their biggest problem is the fact that they have not really solved the economic problem. And it's a big problem. When you have over 25% unemployment, you got a serious problem. And especially if it's concentrated in the youth of the country. Because you have people both in the ANC, the African National Conference, as well as outside of it, that want to appropriate or expropriate, nationalize, I call it stealing, the businesses, the banks, the farms of the people that have the property that are largely white. So it's going to be interesting with the death of Nelson Mandela whether or not South Africa will get its act together in terms of economics, in terms of the economy. And you have, and this is going on and continues to go on to this day, you have white flight from South Africa. And their biggest problem is just education. They spend about 20% of their budgets on education. But the education is, especially for blacks, terrible, terrible. And so are the teachers. So unless you're from a family that has done well, a prospering business owner, you're stuck in poverty. And that is a very dangerous situation because it's ripe for demagogues. It's ripe for a return to terrorism. And that's what Nelson Mandela, when he was in the ANC, did. He led a group that was responsible for terrorism in the ANC. So I'm not going to elevate. Let him rest in peace. And remember, he did spend 27 years in prison. But he was in prison for a reason. Whether you like, at that time, it was a white-dominated, controlled society. It was a racist society. But what happened was, apartheid became a hobby horse, if you will, of the American left in the United States. And Mandela became the poster boy for liberals, both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They don't call themselves liberals anymore. They like to call themselves progressives. And in preparing the show, I was reminded by someone that used to be a leftist, David Horowitz. He's what's called a red diaper baby. He is a child. His mother and father were communists. Belong to the American Communist Party. But if you ask them what they believe, what their political philosophy is, they would always say, and this is what he's saying, it's not my recollection, they would always say, we're progressives. We're progressives. And if you asked them, what party do you belong? Oh, we're registered Democrats. Keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that's what communists did. They didn't want you to know that they were communists. They have an agenda. Doesn't really change. So I'm not going to be one promoting the sainthood of Nelson Mandela. He's dead. He soon will be buried. As far as I'm concerned, good riddance. I'm a little bit taken aback and surprised by some of these people that are liberal or progressive Republicans. Some are actually, some would consider conservatives. That are really praise after praise after praise with no discussion of the history of the party that Nelson Mandela belonged to. None. They won't discuss it. They won't discuss it. It's a whitewash, folks. And the media is part of it. Because the media predominantly is liberal? No. They're predominantly progressives. Now, I'm not saying they're communists. Some of them are, but most of them are progressives, formerly known as liberals. They're for big interventionist government, just like Nelson Mandela was. This is a, what we saw yesterday was a collectivist caucus celebrating Nelson Mandela. He's no hero of mine. Just the opposite. And what literally disgusts me is not one single U.S. president went to the funeral of Margaret Thatcher. Yet Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, and yes, Barack Obama fly off to South Africa to honor the memory of Nelson Mandela. Shame on them. Now, I'm not surprised that Barack Obama went. I'm certainly not surprised that Jimmy Carter went, nor for that matter, Bill Clinton. They're proud to be progressives. They are for big interventionist government. They are collectivists. But if you had any doubts that we don't have progressives in the Republican Party, we do. And he lives in Dallas, George W. Bush. You see, none of them would take the time and go to Margaret Thatcher's funeral. An ally of the United States, a believer in free enterprise and capitalism and democracy and freedom and liberty, can't go there. Yes, she was part of the Tory Party, or what in the United States would be called conservatives, but a firm supporter of the United States and Ronald Reagan. Didn't have time to go to her funeral. But they sure made time to go to the terrorist, communist, African National Congress member, party man, Nelson Mandela. Shame on them. Not surprised. Certainly not disappointed. Disgusted is probably the right way to describe this. And I understand you got to consider his full life. But a lot of that life was dedicated to his party that were trying to intimidate moderate blacks and were successful at it. They burned out businesses. They killed, and it's primarily blacks. Some whites definitely got hurt, but mainly moderate blacks in South Africa were attacked by the African National Congress. And guess who is on the cover of the current edition of the Richland Chronicles newspaper? Nelson Mandela. Not surprised, because our editor of the paper is from South Africa, and his father and grandfather were members of, guess what? The African National Congress. I almost said conference. Congress. The ANC. Today, a lot of the ANC has, if you will, because you're in a single-party government, is now a bigger church. And that's really not the right word. They have a bigger tent. So you actually have people that are not for socialist government or communist government or big interventionist government or support free enterprise and capitalism. But they're a minority. It's like in the United States. It's a two-party country. Even though we have more than a dozen political parties, the way it works in the United States, you got to decide which party to run on. And most people, what they do is they, whatever their political philosophy is, determine which is the closest one. See, I'm what's called a classical liberal. In the United States, that description would be a libertarian. In Europe, and most of the world, but in Europe, it's called a liberal. Not to be confused, please, with an American liberal. You see, what happened was, in the United States, especially when Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, was defeated, and he did not get the Republican nomination, Taft did, and who won? Because Teddy Roosevelt split the vote, Woodrow Wilson, a progressive, won, running on the Democratic ticket. But Roosevelt bolted the Republican Party, ran on being a progressive, which he was, and lost. So what happened is gradually, rather than use the progressive label, especially after Woodrow Wilson, but also Roosevelt, many liberals, the American definition of a liberal, or let me back up. What happened initially, many progressives, both in the Democratic Party, Republican Party, because of the failures of the progressives and the shortcomings of the progressives, changed their name. And guess what they changed their name to? Liberal. And mainly, it started with FDR, to some extent with Hoover, too. But in 1932, when he got elected, Zucco office in March of 1933. He preferred, and the people that supported him preferred, the term liberal. Now, what's happened since, fast forward to today, liberal has largely been discredited, so you change your name back. What do? They change their name back to progressives. Now, for some of you out there, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. And the best way for me to describe it is they want bigger government. Government is the answer to everybody's problem. We need a new law. We need a new regulation. We need a new program. We need more government spending. That is the answer to the American society's problems. Progressivism, in other words, bigger government. That's what they stand for. Both intervention in domestically in the U.S. economy by higher taxes, more regulation, more government spending, or intervention abroad. And we have them in the Democratic Party that is largely, for all practical purposes today, the Democratic Party, they could be called the Progressive Party. That's what most of them want to be called. There are a few socialists there, but most of them, if you asked them, well, what's your political philosophy? They will say, I'm a progressive. And what does that mean? I'm for more government spending. I'm for more welfare spending. I'm for more entitlement spending. And in addition to that, on the Republican side and some Democrats, I'm for more military spending because they're big interventionist government status. I call them the bigs, and we have them in both parties. You better believe we have them in both parties. Now, I want to be very clear. Although communists, especially American communists, and that is a smaller and smaller and smaller group. No one in the United States wants to be called a communist. That's like calling someone a racist. You call a liberal, you're a communist. Oh, you're not. But that's what the progressives, anyone that's critical of the progressive agenda of the Democratic Party, you're a racist. No, I just don't want big government because it doesn't work very well. And it takes most of my money, and it has an attitude. What's its attitude? We know better than you. You want an example of that? Obamacare. We know better than you what you should buy and pay for. Obamacare is an excellent example of the bigs, big interventionist government status. What they're really saying, you're too stupid to buy your own health insurance. So we're going to design a plan that fits everybody. Hasn't worked out very good, has it? But that's what they're about. And then they have a very elitist attitude. We know better than you. And Exhibit A today is Obamacare. And I'm not going to get on Obamacare other than to mention this for a couple of minutes, because I'm finding out even more and more things that stunning, and I'll spend a minute on it. But what Obamacare was about, and people are waking up to this, especially the young people are waking up to this. The problem in the health insurance industry was young people, typically, if you look for the group that has the biggest uninsured, those are young people, typically between 18 and 29 and even older. Now, why? Because most people between 18 and 29, especially if they're single, make a rational decision that they probably will need little, if any, health care, actually health care services, because they typically don't get sick, nor do they have major medical conditions such as heart attacks, strokes, cancer, or any other sickness or disease that requires a major expenditure of money. Yeah, occasionally you're going to have a broken arm or sprained wrist or sprained ankle, or you might have a serious cold or infection. They're not saying they don't have any need for any medical care, but actuarially they understand that their needs for medical care, health care, whether it's a doctor, hospital, combination of that, therapy, is very, very low. And what many young people do, especially before they get married, is that what's not high on their buy list is health insurance. Now, if an employer is willing to pay for it, yeah, if I don't have to pay anything, all I got to do is sign up, I'm going to take what my employer provides as a benefit. But if they're on their own or they're working for a company that doesn't offer it, they have better or higher priorities for other things to spend their money on. It could be a car. It could be a stereo. It could be a down payment on a house. It could be a whole host of things. But they're not big buyers of health insurance. Now, the dirty little secret about Obamacare was it was targeted at young people to force them to buy health insurance. And not cheap health insurance, expensive health insurance. Why? Where do you think those premium dollars are going to? Yeah, the insurance companies make a little profit, and they have some administrative charges. But where do you think those premium dollars are going? They're paying for the health benefits of people that are older and sicker and that have what's called a serious pre-existing condition. And what's unique, historical, is the Congress, when it was controlled by the Democratic Party, progressives mandated, which is a nice word, it's mandated, it's government coercion forcing you to buy a product that you may or may not be able to afford and may or may not want. That is Obamacare in a nutshell. And what we're seeing today is individuals, because remember, initially, who gets affected? And we're hearing that in the news starting 1 October, going for these through March. If you do not have health insurance through your employer, you are required by law to either buy it on these so-called health exchanges, and most of the states don't run their own exchanges. A few do, such as California. But Texas and other states use the federal health care .gov site. That's the website that's in the news, and that's at the laughing stock. You're forced to buy one of these government designed and approved and qualified health insurance plans. And what young people are finding out, to the extent that they go on the sites, and not many of them are, and the reason is they're waking up. They've been had. And one segment that I was going to cover, and I'll just touch on it here before the ice storm, was Harvard's, trying to think of the name, it's a political institute. They did a survey of the millennials. And what they were finding is they've woken up. They don't like Obamacare or Obama anymore. They disapprove of what he's doing. Now, he has his core base of maybe 35%. It depends on the question. They did a poll, a number of questions, and they don't like Obama handling of the deficit, and he's run up major deficits, which we'll touch upon in a moment, major deficits, and they're continuing. Let me just mention that. For fiscal year 2009, 10, 11, and 12, 4 years in a row, the deficits were over $1 trillion, 1.4, 1.3, a little under 1.3, a little under 1.1, and the fiscal year just ended, and I pulled it up just before the show. Last year, fiscal year 2013, that ended September 30th, we ran a deficit under $1 trillion. That's the good news. That's the good news. But what do you think the deficit is? And that's where outlays exceed tax revenues. In other words, total government spending, what's called outlays, that's the term they use, last year, in round numbers, was $3.4 trillion. $3.4 trillion. Now, what do you think we collected in taxes? And we actually collected in taxes quite a bit, one of the best years in several years. In round numbers, I'm going to round up in this case, $2.7. If I round up, it's 2.8. So do the math, subtract that. Well, it makes the deficit $680 billion. $680 billion. Now, there's a reason I'm giving you these numbers. Just hold on. I haven't given you the punchline yet. And there is a punchline.
It's actually a tap, like a real soft tap. It's not really a punchline, but it's a tap.
Now, I was curious, because I knew, ladies and gentlemen, I need to say this. I normally say this earlier in the show. To listen to my show, you go to prankpops.wordpress.com. That's a companion blog to my show. And at the very top, I have links to the most recent shows. And then underneath, I have a complete archive. Now, I'm seriously considering putting the archive on the bottom for a number of reasons. But at the very top, you have links where you click on it and you go directly to the most recent show that you've clicked on. And what I plan to do this evening is to do not only the very short show, but I'm also going to shoot to try to get today's show. We're a web radio show. We do not go over the commercial airways. So the people that are hearing me right now are on the internet. But what I do after the show, I do a little editing, not very much, and I post it to Podomatic so you can listen to the show at your convenience. You can either download it and then listen to it, or you can just stream it. So you have a link at the top that will take you there so you can listen to the show. And the way you get there is to go to Pronk Pops, that's PronkPops.wordpress.com. And what I have underneath those links and the archive, which I'm still debating whether I should leave it at the top or put it at the bottom. Under that, to at least for now, you'll have my research or show preparation called Show Prep. And I'm rather selective. I will give you videos. I will give you articles. I will give you graphs. For example, I'm looking at the very top of one segment that I'll be posting this evening. I actually have the monthly Treasury statement that the Department of Treasury, the U.S. Department of Treasury, publishes every month on the 8th business day, and guess what? It's published, because I was kind of curious what was the total deficit for October, November. If you add them together, what would you think the total deficit would be? Now, I told you last year the total deficit for last year was $680 billion. So what do you think the total would be for the first 2 months? Well, hang on to your seats. Ladies and gentlemen, for the first 2 months of fiscal year 2014 that started 1 October, we have run a deficit of $226 billion. Man, we're really revving those engines. We're spending that money that the American people don't have. We're spending way beyond our means. We did it in 2009, 10, 11, 12, over $1 trillion. Last year, we had some progress. We got down to $680 billion. But if this continues at this rate, we're in for another fiscal year of over $1 trillion. Ladies and gentlemen, what we have in Washington, D.C. today is dysfunctional, divided government. And let me tell you how dysfunctional it is. If you've been listening to the news, what's in the news today and yesterday, and it'll probably be in the news tomorrow, is the House, under the leadership of the budget chairman, Paul Ryan, and in the Senate, and he's a Republican because the House is controlled by the Republican Party, and he considers himself a conservative, and I would even say probably a libertarian or classical liberal, what I do, although I have my doubts. He negotiated with Senator Patty Murray from Washington, a progressive liberal Democrat. This is the first time in 3 years that they have come to a tentative agreement on a budget for fiscal year 2014. And they're making a big deal of this, and it is somewhat of a big deal, and they should have been doing this for the last 3 years. The problem is the Senate, controlled by the Democratic Party, refused to do it. They didn't want to be called on the carpet for this outrageous spending that they do. Now, what Paul Ryan is doing, as well as Senator Patty Murray is doing, is playing what I call the budget shuffle. And I'll bottom line what
the big deal, the big number is. Are you ready? Over the next 10 years, they will reduce the deficit by, are you ready for this? Hang on to your hats. $23 billion. Now, that's over 10 years. If you sit for 1 year, the average for 1 year would be $2.3 billion. Now, I wish I had $2.3 billion. That would be a big number for me. That would be a huge number for me. But that is chump change. That's not even a rounding number. That's not even a day's spending of the federal government in terms of its deficits. It's a joke, folks. As Mark Levin said, it's Mickey Mouse. Now, Paul Ryan will be the first to say, well, we have divided government. We've come to agree. Is it enough? No. Now, the game the Republicans have played, well, we're for balanced budgets, and we're for a balanced budget amendment. And when the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency under George W. Bush, they ran deficit after deficit after deficit. Yes, it was much smaller than now. It was under $500 billion. And I can remember that last year of the Bush administration, the press were crucifying Bush for the deficits. Now, what you got to understand is all money bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. So the president can propose any budget he wants. It's a request, folks. It doesn't matter whether it's a Republican president or Democratic president. The budget proposal that they're required to submit to Congress, for example, in last February, and the president was late. I think it went into March. I forget. He was several weeks late. And I even forget the numbers. They're irrelevant because it doesn't matter. Because Congress is the one responsible for money bills. So that means spending bills and tax bills, revenue bills. And once the House passes its budget, passes it in committee, passes it in the House, then the Senate passes their budget. And they go through a process of negotiating, which they just did, to have a budget for 2014 that started 1 October, a little late. And the bottom line is they're going to reduce the deficit by $23 billion. You see, the game both parties play is everything is over a 10-year period. And what I tell people over and over again, I'll tell you again, ignore that nonsense. That's a game. The only thing that matters is the current fiscal year. And reducing the deficit by less than $3 billion is a joke. And that's what you get when you have a divided, dysfunctional government in Congress. Ladies and gentlemen, for all practical purposes, the budget should be balanced every year. And we haven't done that. Oh, actually, they did it 1 year, 1 or 2 years under Clinton. But generally, ever since the progressives took power, actually before that, I need to be fair here. Herbert Hoover was running deficits. So did FDR. We've run deficits. The problem is the magnitude of them today is the problem. That's what's different. I'll be the first one to say Democratic and Republican presidents have run deficits. It's the order of magnitude. Because where you have a deficit, you have to pay, the government has to pay its bills. How does the government pay its bills? How does the government pay its bills? It borrows. That's why, ladies and gentlemen, we have today a national debt over $17 trillion, quickly going to $18 trillion, especially if we keep it up at this pace. And they have to negotiate a new debt ceiling. Probably make it about $20 trillion. I'm joking there. I'm not in favor of it. Government spending is out of control, both mandatory and discretionary spending. All the Democrats want to do is increase entitlements such as Social Security, Medicare, and Obamacare. And increase welfare. And if you add that with defense, you're over 60% of spending. We need what needs to be done, and it's not being done. And I'm not saying it should be done in a year, but it should be done over the shortest period possible. And I would say that's 3, maybe 4 years.
is to get to balance the budget. That is the goal, and it should be achieved. Now, all Ryan keeps saying is, well, over 10 years, our budget will finally balance. Mr. Ryan, we don't have 10 years. Both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have been playing this stupid game that is causing this country to go down the drain. What do you think running these massive deficits does to business owners? First of all, it increases uncertainty as to what you're going to be doing. But as a business owner, a former business owner, that clients are all business owners, I will tell you, my perception is the federal government is out of control. They can't balance their budget. They cannot live within the means of the American people. And ultimately, what that means is we're going to be taxed one or two ways. Either they're going to tell us they're going to increase the taxes, and that's what the Democratic Party wants, or they're going to increase our taxes through inflation. One or two of those two things are going to happen. And you got to pay the principal on interest on this debt. So they're at it again, folks. And what's happening is some conservatives, some members of the Tea Party, especially in the Senate, say we're not going to go along with this charade. What I favor, and some people, mainly Republicans, but a lot of conservatives favor, not all conservatives, but a lot of conservatives favor, is to keep the sequester. And I know that means cuts in defense spending. But keep it. Don't make these changes. This is eyewash. This is a joke. It's beyond Mickey Mouse. This is just more and more irresponsibility and trying. It's window dressing. Now, Paul Ryan is a fast talker, and he knows his stuff. He does his homework. Well, Mr. Ryan, I do my homework, too. And you were pressed by Mark Levin. I can't get you on my show. But you were pressed, and Levin is getting smart. He's doing his homework, too. This is less than a day's deficit that they're puffing their chest out. We have $23 billion deficit over 10 years. You know, they whisper that over 10 years. You do the math. That's less than that's $2.3 billion. And what did I say? Deficit, let me give you two months. In October, now this is the deficit. I'm not saying what the spending was. I'm just telling the deficit. The deficit for October was $91 billion. That's right around $3 billion a day. So they're going to reduce the deficit by less than a day. That's progress, folks. That's less than 1%. Now, what was November's deficit? Going up, $135 billion was the deficit in November. That's more than $3 billion a day. But we're going to save less than $3 billion. Aren't you impressed? Now, Ryan likes to say, well, we're back to regular order. We actually have reconciled the budgets. That's progress. Yeah, a real tiny, 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 tiny bit of progress. And that's the problem with dysfunctional, divided government. Now, the problem is, let's say the Democrats, they're not going to do this, but let's say the Democrats got control of the House, kept control of the Senate, they have the presidency. What would they do? You know what they would do. I know what they would do. They would go on a spending binge, exactly what they did when Obama came into office, where we ran the first year a deficit of 1.4, then 1.4 trillion, 1.3 trillion, and then slightly under 1.3 trillion. These are record deficits. Spending is out of control, and I know the major drivers of these deficits are entitlement programs as well as welfare programs, and to a lesser extent, defense. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not dealing with the problem. And what are the economic consequences of letting this problem fester and fester and fester? Your sons, daughters, friends, relatives, and maybe yourself can't find a job. It's high unemployment rates because businesses are scared that we might go into another recession. Some would say, including me, we never got out. Now, I'm going to say for next show a discussion of the unemployment numbers that came out Friday when the roads in Dallas were frozen. And the unemployment rate, I'll at least give you a highlight or a teaser, went from 7.3% to 7%. And the non-farm payroll numbers went up about 200,000. two things you need to understand. The only reason we had 200,000 is you had over 400,000 jobs, according to this survey, the establishment survey. Government, 400,000 approximately jobs were created in the government sector. They must be hiring someplace in the government, and that's state, local, and federal. I'm a little bit questioning that number. I think we got to wait for probably April to get a better handle on it. And a lot of news readers, and that's all they do, they read it. They don't understand what they're talking about. That's a great report. It went down from 7.3 to 7%. Oh, and I say this every time I do my unemployment report or my update. What you need to understand is just to keep even with population growth. The fact you have new people, what's called new entrants into the labor department, into the labor market, not department, into the labor market. These are high school and college, either dropouts or graduates, that look for their first job. They're new to the labor market, new entrants. You'll get a range of estimates from economists, including me, that say every month, you need between 130,000 and 150,000. I tend to be on the high end. And the Department of Labor, former commissioner, was asked this question many times. Now, his range was somewhere between 130,000 to 140,000. That depends on the labor participation rate that you assume. But what I'm trying to make a point is, just to keep up with people that are seeking their first job, you need to be producing at least that number of jobs. But if your goal is to reduce the unemployment rate by just a tenth of a percent, 0.1, remember it went down 0.3%, you need 300,000 jobs. And that's for 1 month. Ladies and gentlemen, for the last 12 months, we've produced on average less than 200,000 jobs. It's about 191,000. I'm ballparking it here. There's a chart that I'll put up that shows the numbers. That's not really that good because it's just barely keeping up with people entering the labor market. It's better than the previous 12 months. I need to say that. There is some improvement. You see, for this so-called recovery has been the worst economic recovery, post-World War II recovery. We are still approximately 3 million jobs short of the peak in employment in November of 2007. That's 6 years ago. We're still not back to the employment level in November of 2007. And that was 146.6 million. I'm rounding up. We're still about 3 million jobs short. That's why it's the worst economic recovery. What's happening, ladies and gentlemen, is the economy is not growing. And why is it not growing? It's because of the uncertainty generated out of Washington, D.C. by both political parties, by these massive deficits year in, year out, year in, year out, and all we get is a lot of spin, public relations nonsense. We cut the deficit by $23 billion. Give me a break. That is a joke, and Paul Ryan admitted it. He knows it. And he's quick to say, well, we don't control the Senate. And Levin got him on this, and I'll repeat it. Oh, yes, I remember when the Republican Party controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency. You couldn't balance a budget then. That's my biggest concern. Let's assume, and I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I need to state that. My political philosophy is classical liberalism. I'm a classical liberal. But to keep it simple, that's called a libertarian in the United States. In Europe, it would be called a liberal. We believe in limited government. We believe in balanced budgets. Not 1 year, every year. And by limited government, I believe we could cut the size of government by half and nobody would miss it. That's the problem. Government is out of control. Government spending is out of control because both political parties are totally incapable of balancing a budget that every individual, every business, charity, city, college, every state in the United States must do. Our Congress is totally, completely incompetent, incapable of doing. There's no will, there's no courage, there's no understanding, there's no vision to the damage this is doing to this country. We've had over 7% or more unemployment rate, which is over 11 million people. Every single day President Obama has been in office. Every single day. And part of the problem of these out-of-control, massive government spending and resulting in deficits on deficits, trillion-dollar deficits, and more added to the national debt. Every dollar the government spends, about 35 cents out of every dollar must be borrowed. It used to be 40 cents out of every. They actually have made some improvement. I wouldn't have cut the deal. I would have let the sequester in place. That's the only thing that was making any progress. And our geniuses in the Republican Party cut this deal. Well, we're back to regular order. No, you're not. You're totally fiscally irresponsible. And as a part of the Tea Party movement, I oppose this deal. Oppose it. As conservatives should oppose it. And I'm forgetting, I wish someone in Ohio would run against John Boehner. The problem is the Republican leadership is not something to write home about. And they always let, you know, they call the people in the Tea Party movement racist. The people in the Tea Party movement aren't racist. All the principal demands of the Tea Party was to balance the budget and no more bailouts. What does that have to do with racism? Because I'll tell you something. If we did that, we wouldn't have unemployment rates over 7%. And that's the U3 number. The U6 number is over 12%. I don't have the exact number in my head, but I'll dig it out when I go over in detail the report. I didn't really have time to do it today, but I'll do it probably tomorrow. So what do you do? Let me tell you what you don't do. You don't give a speech, which the president did, which I was going to cover last Wednesday before we were cut short, saying that the problem of the United States is the unequal distribution, household income inequality. That's the word I was looking for. That's the number one economic problem. You see, when the president's poll numbers are plummeting, and they are plummeting, they're continuing to go down, he needs to change the subject. And what he reverts, he regresses. What I call his class warfare rhetoric. It's we against them. It's the middle class against the rich. Mr. President, that is not the number one economic problem. The one, really, if you ask any American, what is the problem today? There are not enough jobs. People are not working. Forget about the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics number. You have about 30 million people today seeking a permanent full-time job and can't find it. Either they're unemployed or they're employed part-time. And that's just the simple facts of life. And the answer is not extending unemployment benefits. The answer is not an increase in the minimum wage. The answer is to control federal government and balance the budget. The answer is to have a reduction in taxes and a reduction in regulation so you have a friendly business environment in which individuals are encouraged and have the incentive to start and build and grow new businesses. Because where the wealth, the income, and jobs come from is in the private sector, in particular with small to medium-sized business owners. You need business formation. You need capital formation. And that will get you the jobs. That will put people back to work. That will put America back to work. And I'll even say this to the Democratic progressives out there. That will increase government revenues. Because when people are working, guess what? They pay payroll taxes and they pay income taxes. At least half of them pay income taxes. All of them have to pay payroll taxes. But only about a little over 50%, about 51, 52% of people that work today pay income taxes. And that's part of the problem, too. We do need income tax reform. I'm for what I call the fair tax less, which is a consumption tax. You don't hear Republicans talking about that. You'll never hear a Democrat do that. They want another tax. If their dream, their fantasy, is to have another new tax called the value-added tax. That is their fantasy dream. If they could get enough people elected in the Senate and the House, that's what the Democratic Party would do. They would pass a value-added tax as well as increase the income taxes. Why? Because they want more and more government spending. They simply cannot learn from the past that the answer is not another government program. The answer is not another law. The answer is not another tax. An answer is not more regulation. That does not increase the wealth, the income, and the jobs of a nation. The answer is not more big government. It has failed in the 1930s. It has failed wherever it has tried. That's why most welfare states have the same, in some cases, worse problem as the United States does with its national debt of over $17 trillion and its unfunded liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare, over $130 trillion. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, trillion dollars. And to put it in context, the GDP for this year will be, I believe, slightly under $17 trillion. That is the value for all final goods and services produced in this country in a 1 year will be slightly less than $17 trillion. Yet we have unfunded liabilities where we can't pay for the future benefits that the government has promised you of over $130 trillion. You see, ladies and gentlemen, those unfunded liabilities can never be paid, and neither can the national debt. That's how bad it is. And I'm an extremist. I'm the problem. I'm a racist extremist nut. I'm part of the Tea Party movement. These are the lunatics in Washington. They're the problem. They're out of control. This is worse than, I call it, spending addiction disorder, SAD. They have a terminal case of SAD, spending addiction order. Both parties do. That's why I'm not a Republican or Democrat. These guys are nuts. They should be locked up in an insane asylum. They have a big addiction problem. Besides the smoking and the drinking and the drugs and the cocaine and the pot that goes on in D.C., their biggest problem, their biggest addiction is spending addiction disorder, SAD. And it is sad, folks, because it's your money that's paying for this habit. We're paying the bills, and your sons and daughters, your friends, your relatives, and maybe even you are paying the price when you can't find a job. Or if you can find a job, it's part-time. The professional politicians, their number one priority is getting reelected, to stay in power. And that includes Republicans and Democrats. That's the only way you're going to get their attention. You've got to have vote them out of office. They got to go cold turkey. And the only way they go cold turkey is to get the turkeys out of Congress. Get those SAD addicts, these spending addicts, get them off your back by throwing the SOBs out of office. That's what needs to be done. That is one of the solutions. And I'm finally seeing some encouragement that the young people of the United States are waking up, the so-called millennials. They've been had. They've been conned. They bought into the whole hope and change nonsense of Barack Obama. And they finally waken up. They've been lied to, and they know it. It's not only Obamacare. It's also the National Security Agency spying on Americans, which hopefully sometime in the near future I'll do a show on. It's been a while. Need an update there, but it needs to be done. Because that is another hot issue with people that are young. It's a hot issue with me. Because not only is it a big waste of money, you need these data centers to store the information. They're storing all your telephone. Not only do they have your telephone records for about the last 7 to 10 years, and maybe even longer than that. They're collecting all your financial records, all your photographs you've posted, anything you posted online, any videos, any blog posts. You name it, if it's gone over the internet or if it's gone over a telephone, whether it's a cell phone or over the wires, guess what? The National Security Agency has a copy of it. They're archiving it, just like I have an archive of all my radio shows. And they got my radio shows. They do. They got my videos. They got my email. They got yours. They got everybody. You know who they're really going for? The world. That's why they build these huge, huge data centers in Utah. I forget where the other one is. It's not jumping into my head. Where they have these server after server after server that stores this stuff. And it's not that hard to do. And they'll deny it. They'll try to confuse you. But they're doing it. And see, the young people are wising up. Because many of them are computer savvy. And that really upsets young people. Now, I've been asked by some of the young students here, well, Ray, where do you stand? I'm with you on this one. And they usually pose the question on Snowden, is he a traitor or a hero? Well, I won't go so far to say he's a hero, but I'm glad he did what he did because he has shined the spotlight on what was going on. And guess what? Your representatives, your House and Senate, especially the ones on the intelligence, they knew about this, especially the ones on the Intelligence Committee of the House and the Senate. And so did the leadership. And another reason for getting rid of Boehner, and I hope John Boehner, and I hope someone in Ohio does go after him. Now, let's be realistic. That's probably not going to happen, or it's not going to be successful. But another issue that I'll just touch on is they're over, last time I checked, over 160 Republicans in the House want the formation of a special committee to investigate Benghazi. Who do you think is holding that up, resisting that? John Boehner. Why? He knew about this. He knows what was going on. He doesn't really want it investigated by a committee. What you need to do is not have multiple committees, the way they're handling it now, investigating. You need one special committee that has a staff, that has counsel or attorneys, that asks the questions, and have asked it first in private and then in public. And John Boehner doesn't want that committee formed. Why? Because if it did, it would come out that John Boehner knew about this and knew what was going on. That arms were being shipped by the CIA, including shoulder-mounted missiles, from Libya, that's why they were there, to so-called Syrian rebels, many of them al-Qaeda, through Turkey. That's what was going on. And that's just part of it. There are many unanswered questions about Benghazi. He doesn't want that investigation. That's why, as far as I'm concerned, it's time for John Boehner to spend more time with his family and his grandchildren. It's time for John Boehner to retire and stop blaming the conservatives, the libertarians, the Tea Party members of his own party that don't think a deal where you cut $23 billion in deficits is anything to write home about. Leave it alone. Leave the sequester in as is. No change. Because the answer is not This is pittance. This is a joke. We need to put in perspective, and I don't think you should do it in 1 year. If you ask me, we should cut at least $250 billion a year and keep cutting until we get a balanced budget, until revenues increase. I said a year. That is more than 10 times what this deal number is for 10 years. I didn't say $250 billion over 10 years. I said $250 billion this year. And that means you got to do entitlement reform. That means you got to cut welfare, and you got to cut defense, and you got to cut the budgets of every department. And as far as I'm concerned, what you truly need to do is permanently close about 8 of them, 8 to 10. They're not talking that. And if they ever got control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they would revert back to what they did in the George Bush year. You better believe it. Yeah, they'll gradually get the deficit down. But there's not going to be any dramatic improvement. You see, there's no sense of urgency. There's no sense of urgency. And there should be. Because there are really only a few people in Congress that understand the importance of this. And Paul Ryan, I think, understands it. But he's trying to put a good face on this. Because he's articulate. He does his homework. He knows how to spin it or lie about it. And I'll give him credit if you've done your homework and know it and ask the tough questions, he'll come clean. But you gotta force him to do that. And you got to be on your toes. And to a certain extent, Levin was doing it. He called it Mickey Mouse. I just think it's a big joke, and the joke is on the American people. And you see, I'm not a fan of Paul Ryan. I'm impressed with him, but I'm not a fan. Because I remember the path for initially came out with the path to prosperity, and he had all these Republicans gathering around. Well, the first time he did it, we're going to balance the budget. You know when he was going to balance the budget? 2037. It's a joke. That's another one. You know, Paul Ryan is a real jokester here. Now, he got caught out on that, and he got a lot of flack on that. So he came back the next year. Oh, we're going to balance the budget. When are you going to do it? In 10 years. See, they never balance the budget this year or next year or the following. It's always 10 years from now. And that's the Republican mantra of the day. We're going to balance the budget when? 10 years. It never happens. Or let's put it this way. It rarely happens. They're lying to you, folks. They're lying. The Democrats and the Republicans are lying to you. And you better wake up, because it's your money and it's your livelihood that's at stake. And economic policies have consequences. Budgets have consequences. Taxes have consequences. And what is the consequences of these policies? It's high and persistent unemployment, especially amongst our young people, throughout the labor force. And really, the only reason, the primary reason, that the unemployment rate has gone down and down is fewer and fewer and fewer people are participating in the labor force. They've left the labor force. They're over 91 million. It's probably today over 92 million people that are not participating in the labor force. Now, some of that, a lot of that, is understandable. You know, mothers staying home with their newborn babies, for example. Or people that are totally disabled. There are some legitimate reasons why people don't participate in the labor force. But there's at least 10 million people, and it's probably closer to 20 million people, that would love to participate in the labor force if they could find a permanent job. And why can't they find a permanent job? I'll give you two good reasons. Out of control, government spending, and Obamacare. See, I view Obamacare as a big tax. It's a big tax on young people, because this insurance is not cheap. It's expensive. And it's expensive because they load the plans up with a lot of benefits they say you must have. For example, I am single, male. I don't want maternity coverage. I don't want pediatric coverage. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I don't want drug abuse and alcohol abuse counseling. I don't want psychiatric care.
Yet they would force me to buy a plan like that. And I hear that over and over and over again. It's like forcing you to buy a car that you can't afford and loading up that car with every option they can think of. The United States is going broke. Some would say it is broke. I know it has a lot of assets that it would sell off, but that's only a partial solution. The real problem is a failure of leadership. That's the big deficit in this country. We don't have leaders, and leaders that are articulate and can explain to the American people what's going on and be honest with them and tell them the problem. That is the problem. There's a lack of people telling the truth. And Paul Ryan understands this, but he goes out there with Patty Murray, and it looks kind of funny because Patty Murray is kind of short, and Paul Ryan is a little bit tall. And we have a deal. Let's make a deal. We got a deal. It's a bad deal for the American people. No deal is the best deal in this situation. Let the sequester in place, and yes, that means defense spending has to be cut. The neocons are having a fit. And let's face it, the military-industrial complex is alive and well. See, that's what's on the Republican so-called conservative side. Part of the problem is government spending across the board, including the Department of Defense, is out of control. You know, Ryan makes the point, well, this is kind of the meat axe approach. Yeah, but the other approach doesn't work. It hasn't worked. No, a better way is to actually have a budget and go line by line by line, department by department, program by program, line by line, and go through it. They don't do that anymore. And I don't have time to get into baseline budgeting, but that's another part of their problem. See, part of my solution is you have to balance the budget every year, and you get rid of baseline budgeting, this projecting over 10 years. But more importantly, you budget to revenues that you collected last year. Just for a quick example, and I need to wrap up the program. Last fiscal year that we just ended, the revenues were, in round numbers, $2.7 trillion. If you round it up, $2.8 trillion. So I would say the maximum spending should be $2.8 trillion. Can be less, but the maximum should be $2.8 trillion. That would be real cuts, folks. Real cuts. That would mean over $600 billion. You see the problem? Spending is way out of control. We spent $3.5 trillion last year. We're on our way to spending more than that next year. And if these numbers continue, and it's hard to estimate this because you don't know what tax revenues are going to be, because that's largely a function of how well the economy is going. But it looks like we're just bouncing back into another $1 trillion deficit in 2014. You see, I think the economy is going to go into another recession, primarily because of Obamacare, and that's going to hit next year. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. I hope today's show was both educational, informative, and a little bit entertaining. And now, back to the music.